Their defense plan had been carefully worked out, bearing in mind normally conservative galactic psychology. The Earthlings' forces were laid out in a mesh, with the larger ships held in reserve. The scheme relied on scouts like him, reporting the enemy's approach in time for the others to coordinate a timed response. Problem was that there were too few scouts to maintain anywhere near complete coverage. Fibbin felt the powerful thrum of engines through his seat. Soon he was hurtling across the starfield. "Gotta give the Galactics their due," he thought. Their culture was stodgy and intolerant, sometimes almost fascistic. But they did build well. Fibbin itched inside his suit. Not for the first time, he wished some human pilots had been small enough to qualify for duty in these tiny Zatenni scouts. It would serve them right to have to smell themselves after 3 days in space. Often, in his more pensive moods, Fibbin wondered if it had really been such a good idea for humans to meddle so, making engineers and poets and part-time starfighters out of apes, who might have been just as happy to stay in the forest. Where would he be now if they refrained? He'd have been dirty, perhaps, and ignorant, but at least he'd be free to scratch an itch whenever he damn well pleased. He missed his local grooming club. Ah, for the glory of being curried and brushed by a truly sensitive chin or chimmy, lazing in the shade and gossiping about nothing at all. A pink light appeared in his detection tank. He reached forward and slapped the display, but the reading would not go away. In fact, as he approached his destination, it grew, then split and divided again. Fibbin felt cold. "If knees incontinence," he swore and grabbed for the code broadcast switch. "Scout ship proconsul to all units. They're behind us. Four battlecruiser squadrons emerging from B-level hyperspace in the fourth dodecant." He blinked as a fifth flotilla appeared, as if out of nowhere, the blip shimmering as starships emerged into real time and leaked excess hyperprobability into the real space vacuum. Even at this distance, he could tell that the cruisers were large. His headphones brought a static of consternation. "My Uncle Harry's twice-bent manhood. How did they know there was a hole in our line there?" "Fibbin, are you sure? Why did they pick that particular—" "Who the hell are they? Can you—" The chatter shut down at once as Major Forthness broke in on the command channel. "Message received. Proconsul, we're on our way. Please switch on your repeater, Fibbin." Fibbin slapped his helmet. It had been years since his militia training, and a guy tended to forget things. He switched over to telemetry so the others could share everything his instruments picked up. Of course, broadcasting all that data made him an easy target, but that hardly mattered. Clearly, their foe had known where the defenders were, perhaps down to the last ship. Already, he detected seeker missiles streaking toward him. So much for stealth and surprise as the advantages of the weak. As he sped toward the enemy, whoever the devils were, Fibbin noticed that the emerging invasion armada stood almost directly between him and the bright green sparkle of Garth. "Great," he snorted. "At least when they blast me, I'll be headed for home. Maybe a few hanks of fur will even get there ahead of the ETs. Anyone wishes on a shooting star tomorrow night, I hope they get whatever the fuck they ask for." He increased the ancient scout's acceleration and felt a rearward push even through the straining stasis fields. The moan of engines rose in pitch. As the little ship leaped forward, it seemed to Fibbin that it sang a song of battle that sounded almost joyful. Chapter 6 Utha Calling. Four human officers stepped across the brick parquet floor of the conservatory, their polished brown boots clicking rhythmically in step. Three stopped a respectful distance from the large window, where the ambassador and the planetary coordinator stood waiting. But the fourth continued forward and saluted crisply.
"Madam Coordinator, it has begun."
The graying militia commander pulled a document from his dispatch pouch and held it out. Utha Kalding admired Megan Oneagle's poise as she took the proffered flimsy. Her expression betrayed none of the dismay she must be feeling, as their worst fears were confirmed.
"Thank you, Colonel Maven," she said.
Utha Kalding couldn't help noticing how the tense junior officers kept glancing his way, obviously wondering how the Timbrimi ambassador was taking the news. He remained outwardly impassive, as befitted a member of the diplomatic corps. But the tips of his corona trembled involuntarily at the froth of tension that had accompanied the messengers into the humid greenhouse. From here, a long bank of windows offered a glorious view of the valley of the Sindh, pleasantly arrayed with farms and groves of both native and imported Terran trees. It was a lovely, peaceful scene. Great infinity alone knew how much longer that serenity would last. And Ifni was not confiding her plans in Utha Kalding at present. Planetary Coordinator Oneagle scanned the report briefly.
"Do you have any idea yet who the enemy is?"
Colonel Maven shook his head.
"Not really, ma'am. The fleets are closing now, though. We expect identification shortly."
In spite of the seriousness of the moment, Utha Kalding found himself once again intrigued by the quaintly archaic dialect humans used here on Garth. At every other Terran colony he had visited, Anglic had taken in a potpourri of words borrowed from galactic languages 7, 2, and 10. Here, though, common speech was not appreciably different from what it had been when Garth was licensed to the humans and their clients more than 2 generations ago. "Delightful, surprising creatures," he thought. Only here, for instance, would one hear such a pure ancient form, addressing a female leader as "ma'am." On other Terran-occupied worlds, functionaries addressed their supervisors by the neutral "sir," whatever their gender. There were other unusual things about Garth as well. In the month since his arrival here, Utha Kalding had made a private pastime of listening to every odd story, every strange tale brought in from the wild lands by farmers, trappers, and members of the Ecological Recovery Service. There had been rumors of strange things going on up in the mountains. Of course, they were silly stories, mostly. Exaggerations and tall tales. Just the sort of thing you would expect from wolflings living at the edge of a wilderness. And yet, they had given him the beginnings of an idea. Utha Kalding listened quietly as each of the staff officers reported in turn. At last, though, there came a long pause, the silence of brave people sharing a common sense of doom. Only then did he venture to speak quietly.
"Colonel Maven, are you certain the enemy is being so thorough in isolating Garth?"
The defense counselor bowed to Utha Kalding.
"Mr. Ambassador, we know that hyperspace is being mined by enemy cruisers as close as 6 million pseudometers, on at least 4 of the main levels."
"Including D-level?"
"Yes, sir. Of course, it means we dare not send any of our lightly armed ships out on any of the few hyperpaths available, even if we could have spared any from the battle. It also means anyone trying to get into Garth's system would have to be mighty determined."
Utha Kalding was impressed.
"They have mined D-level. I would not have expected them to bother. They certainly don't want anybody interfering in this operation." This spoke of substantial effort and cost. Someone was sparing little expense in this operation.
"The point is moot," the planetary coordinator said. Megan was looking out over the rolling meadows of the Sindh, with its farmsteads and environmental research stations. Just below the window, a chim gardener on a tractor tended the broad lawn of earth-breed grass surrounding Government House. She turned back to the others.
"The last courier ship brought orders from the Terrigan's Council. We are to defend ourselves as best we can, for honor's sake and for the record. But beyond that, all we can hope to do is maintain some sort of underground resistance until help arrives from the outside."
Utha Calling's deep self almost laughed out loud, for at that moment each human in the room tried hard not to look at him. Colonel Maven cleared his throat and examined his report. His officers pondered the brilliant flowering plants. Still, it was obvious what they were thinking. Of the few galactic clans that Earth could count as friends, only the Timbrimi had the military strength to be of much assistance in this crisis. Men had faith that Timbrim would not let humans and their clients down. And that was true enough. Utha Calling knew the Allies would face this crisis together. But it was also clear that Little Garth was a long way out on the fringes of things. And these days, the home worlds had to take first priority. "No matter," Utha Calling thought. "The best means to an end are not always those that appear most direct." Utha Calling did not laugh out loud, much as he wanted to, for it might only discomfort these poor, grief-stricken people. In the course of his career, he had met some Earthlings who possessed a natural gift for high-quality pranksterism, a few even on a par with the best Timbrimi. Still, so many of them were such terribly dour, sober folk. Most tried so desperately hard to be serious at the very moments when humor could most help them through their troubles. Utha Calling wondered.
"As a diplomat, I have taught myself to watch every word, lest our clan's penchant for japes cause costly incidents. But has this been wise? My own daughter has picked up this habit from me, this shroud of seriousness. Perhaps that is why she has grown into such a strange, earnest little creature."
Thinking of Athaklena made him wish all the more he could openly make light of the situation. Otherwise, he might do the human thing and consider the danger she was in. He knew that Megan worried about her own son.
"She underrates Robert," Utha Calling thought. "She should better know the lad's potential."
"Dear ladies and gentlemen," he said, savoring the archaisms. His eyes separated only slightly in amusement.
"We can expect the fanatics to arrive within days. You have made conventional plans to offer what resistance your meager resources will allow. Those plans will serve their function. However..."
It was Megan Oneagle who posed the question. One eyebrow arched above those brown irises, big and set almost far enough apart to look attractive in the classic Timbrimi sense. There was no mistaking the look.
"She knows as well as I that more is called for. Ah, if Robert has half his mother's brains, I'll not fear for Athaklena wandering in the dark forests of this sad, barren world."
Utha Calling's corona trembled.
"However," he echoed, "it does occur to me that now might be a good time to consult the branch library."
Utha Calling picked up some of their disappointment. Astonishing creatures. Timbrimi's skepticism toward modern galactic culture never went so far as the outright contempt so many humans felt for the great library.
Wolflings.
Uthakalving sighed to himself. In the space above his head he crafted the glyph called Sealtha, anticipation of a puzzle almost too ornate to solve. The specter revolved in expectancy, invisible to the humans, although for a moment Megan's attention seemed to flutter, as if she were just on the edge of noticing something.
Poor wolflings. For all of its faults, the library is where everything begins and ends. Always, somewhere in its treasure trove of knowledge, can be found some gem of wisdom and solution. Until you learn that, my friends, little inconveniences like ravening enemy battle fleets will go on ruining perfectly good spring mornings like this one.
Chapter 7 Athoclena. Robert led the way a few feet ahead of her, using a machete to lop off the occasional branch encroaching on the narrow trail. The bright sunshine of the sun, Gimil High, filtered softly through the forest canopy, and the spring air was warm. Athoclena felt glad of the easy pace. With her weight redistributed from its accustomed pattern, walking was something of an adventure in itself. She wondered how human women managed to go through most of their lives with such a wide-hipped stance. Perhaps it was a sacrifice they paid for having big-headed babies, instead of giving birth early and then sensibly slipping the child into a postpartum pouch. This experiment, subtly changing her body shape to make it seem more human-like, was one of the more fascinating aspects of her visit to an Earth colony. She certainly could not have moved among local crowds as inconspicuously on a world of the reptiloid Sorrow or the sap-ring creatures of Jofer. And in the process, she had learned a lot more about physiological control than the instructors had taught her back in school. Still, the inconveniences were substantial, and she was considering putting an end to the experiment.
Oh, Ifni!
A glyph of frustration danced at her tendril tips.
Changing back at this point might be more effort than it's worth.
There were limits to what even the ever-adaptable Timbrimi physiology could be expected to do. Attempting too many alterations in a short time ran the risk of triggering enzyme exhaustion. Anyway, it was a little flattering to ken the conflicts taking shape in Robert's mind. Athoclena wondered, is he actually attracted to me? A year ago, the very idea would have shocked her. Even Timbrimi boys made her nervous, and Robert was an alien. Now, though, for some reason, she felt more curiosity than revulsion. There was something almost hypnotic about the steady rocking of the pack on her back, the rhythm of soft boots on the rough trail, and the warming of leg muscles too long leashed by city streets. Here in the middle altitudes, the air was warm and moist. It carried a thousand rich scents, oxygen, decaying humus, and the musty smell of human perspiration. As Athoclena trudged, following her guide along the steep-sided ridgeline, a low rumbling could soon be heard coming from the distance ahead of them. It sounded like a rumor of great engines, or perhaps an industrial plant. The murmur faded and then returned with every switchback, just a little more forceful each time they drew near its mysterious source. Apparently Robert was relishing a surprise, so Athoclena bit back her curiosity and asked no questions. At last, though, Robert stopped and waited at a bend in the trail. He closed his eyes, concentrating, and Athoclena thought she caught, just for a moment, the flickering traces of primitive emotion glyph. Instead of true kenning, it brought to mind a visual image— a high, roaring fountain painted in garish, uninhibited blues and greens.
He really is getting much better, Athoclena thought.
Then she joined him at the bend and gasped in surprise. Droplets, trillions of tiny liquid lenses, sparkled in the shafts of sunlight that cut sharply through the cloud forest. The low rumble that had drawn them onward for an hour was suddenly an earth-shaking growl that rattled tree limbs left and right, reverberating through the rocks and into their bones. Straight ahead, a great cataract spilled over glass-smooth boulders, dashing into spume and spray in a canyon carved over persistent ages. The falling river was an extravagance of nature, pouring forth more exuberantly than the most shameless human entertainer, prouder than any sentient poet. It was too much to be taken in with ears and eyes alone. Athoclena's tendrils waved, seeking, kenning, one of those moments Tim Brimmy glyph crafters sometimes spoke of, when a world seemed to join into the mesh of empathy usually reserved for living things. In a time-stretched instant, she realized that ancient Garth, wounded and crippled, could still sing. Robert grinned. Athoclena met his gaze and smiled as well. Their hands met and joined. For a long, wordless time, they stood together and watched the shimmering, ever-changing rainbows arch over nature's percussive flood. Strangely, the epiphany only made Athoclena feel sad, and even more regretful she had ever come to this world. She had not wanted to discover beauty here. It only made the little world's fate seem more tragic. How many times had she wished Utha Kalthing had never accepted this assignment? But wishing seldom made things so. As much as she loved him, Athoclena had always found her father inscrutable. His reasoning was often too convoluted for her to fathom, his actions too unpredictable. Such as taking this posting, when he could have had a more prestigious one simply by asking. And sending her into these mountains with Robert? It hadn't been just for her safety. She could tell that much. Was she actually supposed to chase those ridiculous rumors of exotic mountain creatures? Unlikely. Probably Utha Kalthing only suggested the idea in order to distract her from her worries. Then she thought of another possible motive. Could her father actually imagine that she might enter into a self-other bond with a human? Her nostrils flared to twice their normal size at the thought. Gently suppressing her corona in order to keep her feelings hidden, she relaxed her grip on Robert's hand and felt relieved when he did not hold on. Athoclena crossed her arms and shivered. Back home, she had taken part in only a few tentative practice bondings with boys, and those mostly as class assignments. Before her mother's death, this had been a cause of quite a few family arguments. Matha Kluwana had almost despaired of her oddly reserved and private daughter, but Athoclena's father, at least, had not pestered her to do more than she was ready for. Until now, maybe? Robert was certainly charming and likable. With his high cheekbones and eyes pleasantly set apart, he was about as handsome as a human might hope to get, and yet the very fact that she might think in such terms shocked Athoclena. Her tendrils twitched. She shook her head and wiped out a nascent glyph before she could even realize what it would have been. This was a topic she had no wish to consider right now, even less than the prospect of war. "The waterfall is beautiful, Robert," she enunciated carefully in Anglic. "But if we stay here much longer, we shall soon be quite damp." He seemed to return from a distant contemplation. "Oh, yeah, Clanny, let's go." With a brief smile, he turned and led the way, his human empathy waves vague and far away. The rainforest persisted in long fingers between the hills, becoming wetter and more robust as they gained altitude. Little Garthian creatures, timid and scarce at the lower levels, now made frequent skittering rustles behind the lush vegetation, occasionally even challenging them with impudent squeaks. Soon they reached the summit of a foothill ridge, where a chain of spine stones jutted up, bare and gray, like the bony plates along the back of one of those ancient reptiles Utha Kalving had shown her, in a lesson book on Earth history. As they removed their packs for a rest, Robert told her that no one could explain the formations, which topped many of the hills below the mountains of Mulan. "Even the branch library on Earth has no reference," he said, as he brushed a hand along one of the jagged monoliths. "We submitted a low-priority inquiry to the district branch at Tanith. Maybe in a century or so the Library Institute's computers will dig up a report from some long-extinct race that once lived here, and then we'll know the answer."
"Yet you hope they do not," she suggested.
Robert shrugged. "I guess I'd rather it were left a mystery. Maybe we could be the first to figure it out." He looked pensively at the stones. A lot of Tim Brimmy felt the same way, preferring a good puzzle to any written fact. Not Athaclina, however. This attitude, this resentment of the great library, was something she found absurd. Without the library and the other galactic institutes, oxygen-breathing culture, dominant in the five galaxies, would long ago have fallen into total disarray, probably ending in savage total war. True, most starfaring clans relied far too much on the library, and the institutes only moderated the bickering of the most petty and vituperative senior patron lines. The present crisis was only the latest in a series that stretched back long before any now living race had come into existence. Still, this planet was an example of what could happen when the restraint of tradition broke down. Athaclina listened to the sounds of the forest. Shading her eyes, she watched a swarm of small, furry creatures glide from branch to branch in the direction of the afternoon sun.
"Superficially, one might not even know this was a Holocaust world," she said softly.
Robert had set their packs in the shade of a towering spine stone and began cutting slices of soya stick salami and bread for their luncheon. "It's been 50,000 years since the Burrali made a mess of Garth, Athaclina. That's enough time for lots of surviving animal species to radiate and fill some of the emptied niches. Right now, I guess you'd probably have to be a zoologist to notice the sparse species list." Athaclina's corona was at full extension, kenning faint traceries of emotion from the surrounding forest.
"I notice, Robert," she said. "I can feel it. This watershed lives, but it is lonely. It has none of the life complexity a wild wood should know, and there is no trace of potential at all."
Robert nodded seriously, but she sensed his distance from it all. The Burrali Holocaust happened a long time ago, from an Earthling's point of view. The Burrali had also been new back then, just released from indenture to the Nahali, the patron race that uplifted them to sentience. It was a special time for the Burrali, for only when its knot of obligations was loosened at last could a client species establish unsupervised colonies of its own. When their time came, the Galactic Institute of Migration had just declared the fallow world Garth ready again for limited occupation. As always, the Institute expected that local life forms, especially those which might someday develop uplift potential, would be protected at all cost by the new tenants. The Nahali boasted that they had found the Burrali a quarrelsome clan of pre-sentient carnivores, and uplifted them to become perfect galactic citizens, responsible and reliable, worthy of such a trust. the Nahali were proven horribly wrong.
Well, what do you expect when an entire race goes completely crazy and starts annihilating everything in sight? Robert asked. Something went wrong, and suddenly the Bur-Arali turned into berserkers, tearing apart a world they were supposed to take care of.
It's no wonder you don't detect any potential in a Garth forest, Clenny. Only those tiny creatures who could burrow and hide escaped the Bur-Arali's madness. The bigger, brighter animals are all one with yesterday's snows.
Athaclena blinked. Just when she thought she had a grasp of Anglic, Robert did this to her again, using that strange human penchant for metaphors. Unlike similes, which compared two objects, metaphors seemed to declare against all logic that unlike things were the same. No galactic language allowed such nonsense. Generally, she was able to handle those odd linguistic juxtapositions, but this one had her baffled. Above her waving corona, the small glyph Tivnus formed briefly, standing for the elusiveness of perfect communication.
I have only heard brief accounts of that era. What happened to the murderous Bur-Arali themselves?
Robert shrugged. Oh, officials from the Institutes of Uplift and Migration finally dropped by about a century or so after the Holocaust began. The inspectors were horrified, of course. They found the Bur-Arali warped almost beyond recognition, roaming the planet, hunting to death anything they could catch. By then, they'd abandoned the horrible technological weapons they'd started with and nearly reverted to tooth and claw. I suppose that's why some small animals did survive. Ecological disasters aren't as uncommon as the institutes would have it seem. But this one was a major scandal. There was galaxy-wide revulsion. Battle fleets were sent by many of the major clans and put under unified command. Soon the Bur-Arali were no more.
Athaclena nodded.
I assume their patrons, the Nahali, were punished as well.
Right, they lost status and are somebody's clients now, the price of negligence. We're taught the story in school, several times.
When Robert offered the salami again, Athaclena shook her head. Her appetite had vanished.
So you humans inherited another reclamation world.
Robert put away their lunch.
Yeah, since we're two client patrons, we had to be allowed colonies. But the institutes have mostly handed us the leavings of other people's disasters. We have to work hard helping this world's ecosystem straighten itself out. But actually, Garth is really nice compared with some of the others. You ought to see Demi and Horst out in the Canaan Cluster.
I have heard of them,
Athaclena shuddered.
I do not think I ever want to see...
She stopped mid-sentence.
I do not...
Her eyelids fluttered, and she looked around, suddenly confused.
Dun-dun...
Her ruff puffed outward. Athaclena stood quickly and walked, half in trance, to where the towering spine stones overlooked the misty tops of the cloud forest. Robert approached from behind.
What is it?
She spoke softly.
I sense something.
Huh. That doesn't surprise me with that timbrimmy nervous system of yours, especially the way you've been altering your body form just to please me. It's no wonder you're picking up static.
Athaclena shook her head impatiently.
I have not been doing it just to please you, you arrogant human male. And I've asked you before, kindly, to be more careful with your horrible metaphors. A timbrimmy corona is not a radio.
She gestured with her hand.
Now please, be quiet for a moment.
Robert fell silent. Athaclena concentrated, trying to ken again. A corona might not pick up static like a radio, but it could suffer interference.
She sought after the faint aura she had felt so very briefly. But it was impossible. Robert's clumsy, eager empathy flux crowded it out completely.
"What was it, Clenny?" he asked softly.
"I do not know. Something not very far away, off toward the southeast. It felt like people. Men and neo-chimpanzees, mostly. But there was something else as well."
Robert frowned. "Well, I guess it might have been one of the ecological management stations. Also, there are isolated freeholds all through this area, mostly higher up where the sisin grows."
She turned swiftly.
"Robert, I felt potential. For the briefest moment of clarity, I touched the emotions of a pre-sentient being."
Robert's feelings were suddenly cloudy and turbulent, his face impassive.
"What do you mean?" "My father told me about something before you and I left for the mountains. At the time, I paid little attention. It seemed impossible, like those fairy tales your human authors create to give us Tim Brimmy's strange dreams."
"Your people buy them by the shipload," Robert interjected. "Novels, old movies, 3V, poems?"
Athaclena ignored his aside.
"Uther Kaulthing mentioned stories of a creature of this planet, a native being of high potential, one who was supposed to have actually survived the Burrarali Holocaust."
Athaclena's corona foamed forth a glyph rare to her. Seal-tha, the joy of a puzzle to be solved.
"I wonder, could the legends possibly be true?"
Did Robert's mood flicker with a note of relief? Athaclena felt his crude but effective emotional guard go opaque.
Well, there is a legend, he said. A simple story told by wolflings. It could hardly be of interest to a sophisticated galactic, I suppose.
Athaclena eyed him carefully and touched his arm, stroking it gently.
"Are you going to make me wait while you draw out this mystery with dramatic pauses, or will you save yourself bruises and tell me what you know at once?"
Robert laughed. "Well, since you're so persuasive, you just might have picked up the empathy output of a Gartling." Athaclena's broad gold-flecked eyes blinked.
"That is the name my father used."
"Ah, then Uther Kaulthing has been listening to old sisin hunters' tales. Imagine having such after only 100 Earth years here. Anyway, it's said that one large animal did manage to escape the Burrarali through cunning, ferocity, and a whole lot of potential. The mountain men and chims tell of sampling traps robbed, laundry stolen from clotheslines, and strange markings scratched on unclimbable cliff faces. Oh, it's probably all a lot of eyewash." Robert smiled. "But I did recall those legends when Mother told me I was to come up here. So I figured that it wouldn't be a total loss. I might as well take a Tim Brimmy along to see if she could flush out a Gartling with her empathy net." Some metaphors Athaclena understood quite readily. Her fingernails pressed into Robert's arm.
"So?"
she asked with a questing lilt.
"That is the entire reason I am in this wilderness? I am to be a sniffer out of smoke and legends for you?"
"Sure," Robert teased. "Why else would I come out here all alone in the mountains with an alien from outer space?" Athaclena hissed through her teeth. But within, she could not help but feel pleased. This human sardonicism wasn't unlike reverse talk among her own people. And when Robert laughed aloud, she found she had to join him. For the moment, all worry of war and danger was banished. It was a welcome release for both of them.
"If such a creature exists, We must find it, you and I,
she said at last.
Yeah, Clenny, we'll find it together.
Chapter 8 Fibbin. TAASF Scout Ship Proconsul hadn't outlived its pilot after all. It had seen its last mission. The ancient boat was dead in space. But within its bubble canopy, life still remained. Enough life, at least, to inhale the pungent stench of a 6 days unwashed ape, and to exhale an apparently unceasing string of imaginative curses. Fibbin finally ran down when he found he was repeating himself. He had long ago covered every permutation, combination, and juxtaposition of bodily, spiritual, and hereditary attributes, real and imaginary, the enemy could possibly possess. That exercise had carried him all the way through his own brief part in the space battle, while he fired his popgun weaponry and evaded counterblows, like a gnat ducking sledgehammers, through the concussions of near misses and the shriek of tortured metal, and into an aftermath of dazed, confused bemusement that he did not seem to be dead after all. Not yet, at least. When he was sure the life capsule was still working and not about to sputter out along with the rest of the scout boat, Fibbin finally wriggled out of his suit and sighed at his first opportunity to scratch in days. He dug in with a will, using not only his hands, but the tingers and tum of his left foot as well. Finally, he sagged back, aching from the pounding he had been through. His main job had been to pass close enough to collect good data for the rest of the defense force. Fibbin guessed that zooming straight down the middle of the invading fleet probably qualified. Heckling the enemy he had thrown in for free. It seemed the interlopers failed to appreciate his running commentary as Proconsul plunged through their midst. He'd lost count of how many times close calls came near to cooking him. By the time he had passed behind and beyond the onrushing armada, Proconsul's entire aft end had been turned into a glazed-over hunk of slag. The main propulsion system was gone, of course. There was no way to return and help his comrades in the desperate, futile struggle that followed soon after. Drifting farther and farther from the one-sided battle, Fibbin could only listen helplessly. It wasn't even a contest. The fighting lasted little more than a day. He remembered the last charge of the corvette Darwin, accompanied by two converted freighters and a small swarm of surviving scout boats. They streaked down, blasting their way into the flank of the invading host, turning it, throwing one wing of battle cruisers into confusion under clouds of smoke and waves of noisome probability waves. Not a single Terran craft came out of that maelstrom. Fibbin knew then that TAASF Bonobo and his friend Simon were gone. Right now, the enemy seemed to be pursuing a few fugitives off toward Ifni knew where. They were taking their time, cleaning up thoroughly before proceeding to Supine Garth. Now, Fibbin resumed his cursing along a new tack. All in a spirit of constructive criticism, of course, he dissected the character faults of the species his own race was unfortunate enough to have as patrons.
Why? He asked the universe. Why did humans, those hapless, hairless, wolfling wretches, have the incredibly bad taste to have uplifted neo-chimpanzees into a galaxy so obviously run by idiots?
Eventually, he slept.